Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. We design, craft and install beautiful kitchens. cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb@rte.ie.
Now, as we were hearing when I was talking to James Waterhouse from the BBC, we've got the Coalition of the Willing playing an active role now in dealing with the Ukraine crisis. But who are the key European leaders who are forging a role for themselves? Well, for more on this, I'm joined by Graham Finlay from the School of Politics and International Relations at UCD. And Graham, over the next few weeks, we're going to take a closer look now at some of those leaders who are on the big European stage. And we're starting with the French President Emmanuel Macron. And it felt like he just came out of nowhere in 2017.
It's one of those funny things. I mean, probably most people, when they think about France, they think about Macron. And, you know, but in 2017, he really did come out of nowhere. I mean, he'd been a minister in the government. He'd been an investment banker. But he left the Parti Socialiste to form his own party, En Marche, which I felt thick when it was pointed out to me that those are the same initials as Emmanuel Macron. But
deliberately,
I mean, it's all about him. And it's always been based on his personality, on his presenting a young, new face to French people, an alternative of the center, a sort of radical centrism between the center left and the center right. And because of a scandal involving the sort of the right wing's Les Républicains lead candidate, involving him paying vast sums to his family members for a no-show job, as people call it, I mean, really large sums, Macron suddenly was catapulted into front-runner status with the help of a media which really preferred him to Marine Le Pen, which has been his opponent, who has been his opponent for all these years. So he wins quite handily.
It's quite clever, though, isn't it, to present yourself as a radical, but you're a centrist. And all of that really works because of his charisma.
Yeah, and he has a vision, right? I mean, he presented more than just sort of, we are going to fix this, we're going to fix that. I mean, I think the French voters really respond to broad, you know, philosophical approaches. You know, as a friend and colleague of mine pointed out, and it was very helpful for finding out what French people think about Macron. You know, they want their presidents to write and politicians to write books. You know, ideally they have a degree in philosophy, which Macron has. And you know, this vision of a new France, which was both pro-business and, you know, socially progressive, which was a vision of Europe, which really sets him apart from Le Pen, of a more dynamic, more integrated and a sovereign Europe, which he lays out in some speeches, you know, immediately after getting elected in 2017 and again 7 years later. When he came out to, you know, for his victory speech, both times, because he's reelected in 2022, it's to the sound of Ode to Joy, the European anthem rather than the French anthem. So all of those promises to sort of renew France, France which has felt for decades, I think, that it's in decline in every way. You know, that was the promise of Macron, and it worked for a while.
For a while. So you had the blaze of glory election in 2017, and then 2022, it didn't go his way particularly. So he's had a tricky time for the last number of years.
Yeah, so he gets a massive majority in 2017 in the National Assembly, because these National Assembly elections usually follow the presidential election. The president has a lot of momentum, has a mandate, and voters tend to give the president a mandate in the legislature as well. This led to the election of loads and loads of people who hadn't been in politics before, who, you know, didn't expect necessarily to even be in the National Assembly. Mathematicians I knew from time in the United States, you know, suddenly became members of the French National Assembly. And initially he works with the unions and business, but especially with the unions to progress sort of an agenda which is going to do things which the French people are not so keen on, like extending the retirement age,
yes,
or making it easier to hire and fire people, cutting taxes, especially the wealth tax, which he'd promised to do. Again, he's very, very centrist. So he initially made some progress by working with the unions, but over the course of time, and certainly in the second term, these reforms, which became more and more urgent because of the decline in the French economy, received more and more resistance from the left, and especially from the unions, in terms of demonstrations and even sort of political violence. So in his second term, he gets a minority government, which makes it very, very difficult to make any progress whatsoever. And this culminates, he goes through a succession of prime ministers, but this culminates in the collapse of the government under Michel Barnier, who we all know from Brexit, over austerity measures, which I think many people see as absolutely necessary for France, whose economy really has become so indebted that it's now borrowing at rates which are worse than Greece's. And also, the headline in Le Monde right now, today, is, you know, France's borrowing rates are similar to Italy's, which is shocking to the French public and, yes, and the French mind, because they've always contrasted themselves with the irresponsible Italians. So things are that bad, but the French people and the particular groupings in the parliament were not prepared to accept it. And so Barnier's government collapsed.
And he also had to deal with the Yellow Vest protest as well. And people will remember that was a huge movement overtaken by COVID, wasn't it? Wasn't that just pre-COVID when that happened?
It was. And that's a really good point, because, you know, in a way, he was doing okay by engaging in sort of normal politics, by working with the unions, even though labor politics in France are very confrontational. They love to go on strike, you know, as anybody who's tried to fly through Charles de Gaulle knows, right? But the Yellow Vests sort of came out of nowhere as a seemingly spontaneous response to higher fuel prices. And so they often wore sort of the uniform of a trucker, right, or someone who drives something which consumes diesel. So, which is the yellow vest, right? The warning vest. And but also generally a cost of living crisis and a housing crisis and so forth. And also a protest against inequality in France, because Macron has always been seen as the president for the rich. And that's still a sort of title he has today. And these people who were around then or following would remember, they would be at sort of roundabouts, disrupting and, you know, in quite aggressive sort of form of confrontation. And there were both left and right Yellow Vests who would occasionally fight with each other, because this was really a populist and popular response to what Macron was trying to do and where France was headed. And it was really against the sort of centrism and the normal politics which Macron represents.
But really, it has been the right that has risen over his time in office.
Sure. And Marine Le Pen has been his constant foil, and he's always been this pro-European alternative. How this is going to play out, and there's problems with succession for Macron, but, you know, we know that the National Rally is going to get about 30% in any presidential election. So they'll be going through to the second round. France has a runoff system where the top two candidates go to a second round where you have to get over 50% to become president. Macron has been able to work this pretty well, because the negatives for either Marine Le Pen, who may or may not be able to run because she's been convicted of embezzling European funds, or whether it's Jordan Bardella, you know, her number two, who's an MEP, whoever runs for the National Rally has very, very high negatives. And so there's room for someone to come through on the not Le Pen or not National Rally side. But the leadership has been, and the emphasis has been, shifting to the right. And it's just a question of how long the anything but Le Pen sort of coalition can stay together. Mm-hmm.
So how has he been performing then on the international stage? I mean, most recently we saw him in the White House this week as part of the coalition of the willing.
I think in a way he's been successful at inserting himself into international affairs just through sheer awareness of who he is. I mean, he's a good looking guy. He's very charismatic. I mean, he's been frequently compared to being Francis Obama, right? And like Obama, has disappointed, you know, at least many of his followers. But, you know, he's got a real ability to mollify Donald Trump. And I think we saw a bit of that on show just the last few days. And he in European level, he's again favored this sovereign Europe, and he continues to iterate this, which involves an integration which a lot of European member states would not be keen on, you know. And he certainly gave some momentum to the two-speed Europe, where the people who want to do more, the states who want to do more, which is obviously a threat to small countries like Ireland, who could see themselves being sort of pushed aside by the Franco-German sort of cooperation at the heart of Europe. On the international stage, he initially reached out to Putin, he would go and meet with Putin and have phone conversations with Putin. Even after the invasion of Ukraine, he continued to talk about working with Putin. But since then, he's become one of the more hawkish members of the European Union.
Well, he raised the prospect of European boots on the ground.
Yeah, and he's volunteered French troops even before there was a sort of potential peace deal. So, and the same thing is actually with Donald Trump. While he's gotten along relatively well with Donald Trump, they had a sort of handshake battle, which Macron sort of held his own with. But he has since become one of the more hawkish European leaders on tariffs. Mm-hmm. While Ursula von der Leyen and other people are saying, well, you know, we're going to negotiate, we won't react too quickly. He's in favor of sharp sanctions and sharp tariffs in response. Mm-hmm. Again, at European level, even though he's praised in his speeches the cooperation around debt, shared debt in response to the pandemic, he didn't get the more united Europe that he was looking for, with France right in there at the lead. And again, all of this is a reflection on France's role in the world. And you especially see this in international relations with relationship to France's former colonies and even its own territories. France, as many people will know, has clung to its empire in a more imperial way than most of the former great imperial powers. You know, it takes a very live interest in both the economic affairs by imposing a form of the franc on some of its former polities in sub-Saharan colonies in sub-Saharan Africa, by having a military presence there, and by even asserting a huge amount of influence in Algeria, which used to be an integral part of France. And so we've seen a series of coups across the Sahel, which have been explicitly anti-French, anti-colonial coups with popular protests against outside French military bases. France, in turn, has banned artists from those countries like Burkina Faso and Mali and Niger. And so in French musical venues, which seems petty, but we've seen a loosening grip on their former colonies. And it's right now, and again, front page of Le Monde, there's a battle with Algeria over the imprisonment of Franco-Algerian writers, and just generally a total lack of diplomatic cooperation mm-hmm. between, you know, very, very near neighbors and the former colony. And even in France's own territory, because France has these territories which are part of France all over the world, New Caledonia in the Pacific, there's been a huge uprising, a very violent sort of rebellion against a plan to allow French citizens who are not locals to vote in elections, to the point where they've now agreed a plan which will see New Caledonia on a path to statehood within the French fold. So he really seems weak on the international
stage.
Okay,
so your assessment is that he's going through his lame duck phase and has been for some time. So given that he's only in his 40s, are we at the stage now where we could be talking about Emmanuel Macron's political legacy after the next election?
We could, and we won't have much to talk about. I think, you know, not only do we not have a lot of policies to show, because most of his innovations have been resisted quite successfully by the French left, but also he doesn't have an obvious successor. So the movement is really kind of nowhere, because it was entirely based
on him.
On him and his personality. He doesn't really have an obvious successor. He also doesn't have the grassroots down in the mairie and in the departments of France, the mm-hmm. regions of France.
Because it was also new in 2017.
Yeah, to have a visible presence in those places. So, I mean, there are a number of people jockeying for that not Le Pen position. Two of them are from his movement. They're former prime ministers of his, Edouard Philippe and Gabriel Attal. Sort of young prime ministers like Macron, but they've both fallen out with him recently, and they're not going to be running as Macron's successor. They're going to be running as the people who want to hoover up the voters of Macron. On the right, there's a very hard line, but quite a possibly successful candidate in Bruno Retailleau, who's the Minister of the Interior and is extremely hardline on both immigration and law and order in a way which might put some people off.
Okay.
Whereas the left doesn't really, has a whole slew of candidates, none of whom are at the levels of those candidates.
Yeah, it's fascinating. As I say, this is part of a series where we're going to be taking a look at some of those other names that we hear a lot about on the European stage. Graham, thank you so much. That's Graham Finlay. Back after this quick break.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.